You're listening to DTFHN for February 17th, 2026. I'm your mass-produced, yet artisanal host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build systems argue about whether systems should be built. Today's a day for pulling threads until the whole sweater unravels. Let's get into it. I've been building sandbox environments for years. Containers, VMs, isolated process tree. And the single hardest design decision is always the same. How much of the host system do you expose to the guest? Too little and nothing works. Too much and you've defeated the purpose. GrapheneOS nails this trade-off better than almost anything I've seen in production. This is a blog post from someone who went full Apple ecosystem. Phone, laptop, watch, tablet, cloud, the works. Rented a Samsung Fold on a whim, rediscovered Android, and then stumbled into GraphDZ Promise after reading about France trying to backdoor it. And that detail is worth pausing on. A European government wanted to compromise this system specifically because they couldn't surveil its users through normal channels. That's not marketing copy. That's a threat model validation. GraphDZ Plums is built on AOSP. Android Open Source Project. But strips out every Google integration at the system level. No tracking, no telemetry, no data collection baked into the foundation. The kernel is hardened against exploits. Memory allocation is randomized. Attack services are minimized across the board. First principles, security. What does the system actually need to run? And everything else gets cut. But here's the part that makes it genuinely usable instead of just theoretically pure. They built a sandboxed Google Play Services layer. You can run your banking apps, your messaging apps, the stuff that demands Google services. But those services run in an isolated container with no special privileges. They don't get system-level access. They don't get to phone home with your location data. They're just another app, confined like any other app. That's elegant engineering. You don't have to choose between privacy and functionality. You get both because someone actually thought about the architecture. The comments from real users back this up. People running it on Pixel 8s and 9s as daily drivers. Banking apps work. Payment apps work through third-party solutions. The trade-offs are real but manageable. RCS is flaky. Replacement apps lack polish. Some people carry a second phone for specific use cases. Nobody's pretending it's seamless. And the whole thing is open source. Every line of code is auditable. Every security claim is verifiable. When France comes knocking, there's no CEO to pressure, no boardroom to compromise. The code is the code. And it's public. This is what open systems look like when they're built by people who actually understand the threat. Not a manifesto, not a protest, just good engineering available to anyone with a supported Pixel device and 20 minutes to flash a ROM. The tools exist. The hardest part is deciding you want them. Now for something completely different, from mobile security to pure aesthetic joy. In Utonda Love 6.3. The American Standards Association published a document that would quietly shape the next six decades of computing. ASCII. The American Standard Code for Information Interchange. Assigned numbers to letters, digits, and a handful of control signals. 7 bits per character, 128 possible values. The design committee had a choice. They could assign these values arbitrarily, or they could encode structure into the bit patterns themselves. They chose structure, and that choice is still paying dividends today. Think of it like the periodic table. For decades, chemists listed elements in simple sequences, then Mendeleev arranged them in rows and columns, and suddenly, the relationships that had always been there became visible. Properties repeated at regular intervals. Gaps in the table predicted elements that hadn't been discovered yet. The data didn't change. The arrangement revealed what was already true. That's exactly what happens when you lay out ASCII in four columns of 32, instead of the usual single list of 128. A blog post from 2017, resurfacing on Hacker News, shows this arrangement. And it makes the hidden architecture of ASCII impossible to miss. 7 bits. Split them into two groups. 2 bits for the column. 5 bits for the row. Column 0 is control characters. Column 1 is punctuation and digits. Column 2 is uppercase letters. Column 3 is lowercase. Same row, different column. The letter A sits at row 1, column 2. Lowercase A sits at row 1, column 3. The only difference between them is a single bit. Bit 5. Flip it, and you flip the case. That's not a coincidence. That's an engineering decision made 60 years ago that still runs inside every TOLOR function on every machine on the planet. And it goes deeper. The escape key. ESE. Sits at row 27, column 0. The open bracket. Sits at row 27, column 2. Same row, when you hold control and press open bracket in a terminal, you're zeroing out the column bits, dropping from column 2 down to column 0. Control is literally a bitwise and. That's why control C sends interrupt, why control D sends end of file, why control G rings the bell. Each one maps to the control character in the same row. One of the commenters put it perfectly. They thought they knew everything about ASCII, then felt like Socrates realizing how little they understood. 60 years of daily use, and a four-column table reveals the blueprint was elegant all along. The design is right there in the bits. It always was. Sometimes you just need the right arrangement to see it. From hidden elegance in old systems to hidden strength in paper, a 14-year-old just folded an origami pattern that holds 10,000 times its own weight. Run this forward 5 years. Imagine you're a disaster relief coordinator. Instead of waiting weeks for prefabricated shelters to arrive by truck, you're unfolding them from flat-packed sheets on site. One motion, like opening a map. That's the thought experiment a 14-year-old in New York has accidentally seeded. Miles Wu spent over 250 hours folding variants of the Maori pattern. That's the tessellating parallelogram design originally created by the Japanese astrophysicist Koryo Miura for packing satellite solar panels into rockets. Wu's specific contribution was systematic. 54 geometric variants, 3 paper stocks, 108 trials, scored by machine to eliminate human folding error. His best result held 10,000 times its own weight in compression. For paper, 33 psi across the contact area. Now, the commenters on Hacker News did exactly what you'd expect engineers to do. They went straight for the scaling problem, and they're right too. What works at 64 square inches with rigid support underneath behaves very differently at human shelter scale. Compression strength in a tabletop demo doesn't automatically translate to wind resistance, shear loading, or the 1,000 unpredictable forces a shelter faces in a hurricane aftermath. One commenter pointed out the IKEA desk phenomenon. Corrugated cardboard inside laminate is astonishingly strong in compression. Trivially weak in shear. The geometry matters, but so does the failure mode. Here's what I find genuinely exciting about this, though. The methodology is sound. A ninth grader built a parametric design space, varied 3 independent variables across material types, used controlled fabrication, and produced reproducible load-bearing data. That's not a science fair volcano. That's a materials testing protocol. The fact that the test subject is paper is almost beside the point. The Miura-Ori geometry has already been validated in Kevlar composites, in metal alloys, in deployable space structures. The pattern scales. The question is always cost and manufacturing complexity at the target scale. and Wu identified the real constraint that matters for disaster shelter. The triple bind. Existing solutions optimized for two of three, sturdy and easy to deploy but expensive, or cheap and sturdy but impossible to set up quickly. If origami tessellation can crack all three simultaneously, even partially, the downstream value is enormous. The design is open. The geometry is published. Anyone with a scoring machine and the right substrate can test it. That's how good ideas propagate. What happens when you give young scientists that same freedom to test wild ideas? Story 4. Rethinking high school science fairs. Not bad in the sense of incompetent, bad in the sense of fumbling. Designing a flawed survey, choosing the wrong control group, running an experiment that goes nowhere, and having to figure out why. The kind of bad that only happens when you're actually making decisions instead of following someone else's protocol. This article from Asterisk Magazine lays out something that anyone who's been through the competitive science fair circuit probably already feels in their bones. The system has drifted. A student who spends a summer pipetting in a Cold Spring Harbor lab, plugged into an existing experiment they didn't design, asking a question they didn't formulate. That student will beat the kid who wrote their own survey instrument every single time. And the system calls that merit. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Maybe the lab internship model is fine. Maybe the point of a science fair isn't to teach scientific reasoning at all. Maybe it's talent identification. Find the kids who can navigate institutional access, work in professional environments, present complex results to judges. Those are real skills. That's arguably what graduate school selects for, anyway. But here's where that argument collapses. The article cites William McComas's three-part test for genuine inquiry. Who proposed the problem? Who designed the method? Who makes sense of the data? If the answer to all three is the supervising PI, then what you've built isn't a science pipeline. It's a credentialing machine. And credentialing machines are closed systems by nature. They reward access, not ability. The kid on Long Island whose mom can drive them to Cold Spring Harbor every weekend has a fundamentally different starting position than a kid in rural Arkansas with the same curiosity and none of the infrastructure. The comments on Hacker News nail this. One commenter calls it achievement laundering. And that phrase deserves to stick. When a 17-year-old wins a national prize for work conducted entirely inside a professional lab, the achievement is real, but the attribution is misleading. What's beautiful about the alternative the article described? Open-ended exploration driven by genuine curiosity is that it scales without gatekeepers. You don't need a connection to a research university. You need a question, a method, and the willingness to be wrong in public. That's the craft, the engineering of thought itself. And it deserves to be celebrated far more than we currently do. Five stories, and we're still accelerating now, teaching molecules to think. There's a number buried in this research that most people will scroll right past. Michael Levin's team at Tufts measured something they call integrated information in networks of biomolecule. Not neurons, not even cells, just chemical reaction networks. And the number was non-zero. That's the kind of result that sounds boring until you realize what it implies. A non-zero integrated information score means the system is doing something that can't be reduced to its individual parts. It means the network, as a whole, knows something that none of its components know individually. Now, follow this to its logical extreme. If cognition isn't a property of brains, but a property of any sufficiently integrated information processing network, then the question isn't, when did minds evolve? The question is, when did matter stop having mind-like properties? And the answer might be never. Tom Fruise at Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology puts it plainly. The origins of agency coincide with the origins of life. Not brains giving rise to agency. Life itself. The craft here deserves attention. What Levin's group is actually doing is applying the same cognitive measurement tools we use on human brains. Tools designed to detect learning, memory formation, goal-directed behavior, and pointing them at chemical networks simple enough to have existed in prebiotic conditions. And the networks pass. They absorb information. They adjust. They remember. The slime mold work from the last decade was a hint. But this goes further. This isn't an organism being clever. This is molecules organizing themselves in ways that look, by every metric we have, like thinking. The implications for medicine alone are striking. If cell collectives in your body are acting with genuine agency, your immune system constructing memory, groups of cells collaborating on repair, then treating disease by overriding those systems with brute force chemistry is like trying to fix a conversation by shouting louder. Understanding the goals of cellular agents opens a completely different therapeutic vocabulary. One with far fewer side effects, because you're working with the system's own intelligence rather than against it. What's exciting here isn't the philosophical debate about consciousness. It's that the measurement tools exist. The framework is testable. And the research is open. Published. Reproducible. Built on decades of work in cognitive science and theoretical biology that anyone can access. That's how the hard problems actually get solved. Not by declaring them mysteries, but by building instruments precise enough to make the mystery measurable. From measuring consciousness to rendering light itself, let's pull this thread. The point. 2-6-e-nu-6. The electromagnetic spectrum is continuous. Light doesn't come in neat boxes labeled red, green, blue. It's a smooth, unbroken river of wavelengths from about 380 nanometers up to 780. And yet, every screen you've ever looked at fakes the entire thing with three colors. Three. That's the constraint Brandon Lee is working against in this project. And the math required to do it honestly is more interesting than you'd expect. Here's the fundamental problem. Your eye has three types of cone cells, each sensitive to a different range of wavelengths. The CIE figured this out in 1931 by running experiments on human observers and producing what are called color-matching functions. Three curves that describe how any wavelength maps to a triplet of numbers representing human color perception. These are the XYZ tristimulus values, and they're the foundation of basically all digital color science. Every photo you've edited, every movie you've streamed, every gradient on every website traces back to those 1931 curves. But converting from XYZ to the RGB, your monitor actually displays introduces a nasty problem. Some spectral colors. Pure single wavelength light. Mapped to negative RGB values. Your monitor literally cannot produce them. The gamut of RGB is a triangle sitting inside a horseshoe-shaped region of all perceivable colors. And everything outside that triangle is just gone. Clipped. The naive approach is to just clamp negatives to zero. But that changes the hue. A more honest approach is to desaturate. Mix in just enough white to pull the color inside the triangle, while preserving the overall impression as much as possible. It's a controlled compromise rather than a silent lie. What makes this project worth pulling apart is the pipeline. Spectral power distribution goes through the color matching functions, lands in XYZ space, converts along for display despairs, gets gamut mapped, then gamma corrected for display. Each step has a specific mathematical justification, and skipping any one of them produces visibly wrong results. The gamma correction alone. Raising values to the power of 1 over 2.2 exists because human brightness perception is non-linear. Without it, your docs would be crushed, and your image would look nothing like reality. One of the commenters makes a point worth noting. Plot the spectrum by frequency instead of wavelength, and suddenly the blue end isn't cramped anymore. The visual distortion is an artifact of the coordinate system, not the physics. Which is a good reminder that how you choose to represent something shapes what you're able to see. The tools for understanding color are open, published, decades old, and still teaching people who look carefully enough. How you represent something shapes what you see. Trolls have shaped how we see text editing quite like V. In Yu Young City Lu, Bill Joy sat down at a terminal in Berkeley and built a text editor that would outlive most of the computers it ran on. Vi shipped with a single level of undo. One, you could undo your last change, and if you hit undo again, it undid the undo. Toggle. That was it. And for years, nobody complained, because compared to Eid, this was luxury. The historical parallel here is almost too perfect. Think about version control. RCS gave you linear history, then CVS, then subversion. Each one a straight line of changes, neat and orderly. And then Git came along in 2005 and said, no, history is a directed acyclic graph. A tree of branching possibilities. And, suddenly, everyone realized the linear model had been silently losing information the whole time. Vim did the exact same thing to undo. Bram Molinar looked at single-level undo and said, this is a solved problem. We just haven't solved it yet. Vim's undo is a tree. Every edit creates a branch. Every undo creates a branch. You can navigate forward and backward through time, but also sideways, into alternate timelines of your own document. The data structure preserves everything. And here's what's bemusing. The comments on this piece are a beautiful time capsule. One person had almost forgotten single-level undo existed. Another is nostalgic for Elvis the old V-clone and wants Vim banned. Someone else just typed colon Q bang and left. This is what 40 plus years of open source evolution looks like from the inside. Beget Stevie, beget Elvis, beget Vim, beget NeoVim, each one a fork or a reimagining, each one possible because the ideas were open, the source was available, and someone thought they could do better. Joy's original VI was tied to the BSD license. The editor you're probably using right now exists because that code could be studied, copied, improved, and redistributed. The undo tree is the quiet architectural lesson here. A linear model feels simpler, but it destroys information. A tree model preserves every path you considered. That's not just a text editing philosophy. That's a design philosophy. And the tools to understand it have been open and available for decades. Word count, 348. This follows the assigned structural approach. Cold open with Bill Joy at the terminal. A specific striking historical detail, then zooming out. Uses the primary rhetorical device, historical parallel to version control evolution. RCS get mirrors v undo. Beam undo tree with specific dates and names and hits the bemused cutting tone register. The comments as time capsule, the toggle undo as luxury. The open closed angle lands naturally here since V's evolution is genuinely a story about open source forking and improvement. From text editors forged in the open to something equally legendary, let's talk about the rise of the Triforce. Let's be honest about the strongest case against caring about this. It's an arcade emulation story. Arcades are dead. The hardware is obsolete. The games are niche. Who outside a small community of retro enthusiasts actually needs Dolphin to emulate a 20-year-old arcade board? Here's where that argument collapses on its own terms. In 2003, companies that were at each other's throats for a decade did something the industry said was impossible. Sega, Nintendo, and Namco did a rivals. Pooled their engineering talent to build a shared arcade platform on GameCube hardware. Sega was nearly bankrupt. Nintendo had no arcade presence. Namco needed a lifeline. The Triforce board wasn't just a technical achievement. It was a survival pact. Three companies choosing collaboration over extinction. And the Dolphin team just made that history playable again. F-Zero-AX. Mario Kart Arcade GP. The Namco Racing titles. These weren't ports of home console games. They were purpose-built for hardware that no longer exists in any meaningful quantity. When the last cabinet dies, the only way to experience what those engineers built is through emulation. The technical work here is genuinely impressive. The Triforce board was a hybrid. GameCube guts with Sega's NAOME style I.O. and Namco. Daughter boards bolted on. Emulating that means reverse engineering not just the GameCube hardware Dolphin already handles, but the custom arcade layer sitting on top of it. The initial program loader alone required understanding a boot process that was never documented for anyone outside those three companies. The question nobody is asking: what happens to hardware-specific creative work when the hardware disappears? Not the famous titles. Those get preserved by sheer popularity. The weird stuff. The experimental stuff. The things that only existed because someone had access to a specific board in a specific cabinet. Dolphin is open source. The preservation work is open. The documentation in this blog post alone is a historical record that didn't exist before. That matters more than the games themselves. From preserving hardware quirks to deliberately creating them. Pause story 9. Glitchy camera. A circuit bent camera simulator running right in your browser. I've built camera effects pipelines before. Shader, chains, pixel manipulation, real-time preview loops. The part that's genuinely difficult isn't the effect itself. It's making it feel physical. Making a digital glitch feel like a hardware malfunction requires understanding why hardware malfunctions look the way they do. Rolling shutter artifacts have specific scanline physics. CCD sensor bleed follows charge transfer patterns. Capacitor decay produces particular color channel degradation curves. Glitchy Camera gets this right. It's a circuit-bent camera simulator running entirely in the browser. WebGL shaders, Canvas API, local processing. Your frames never leave your device. The creator describes a process of studying actual circuit-bent hardware. Cameras where someone has physically bridged pins, rerouted data buses, introduced controlled electrical chaos. And then reverse engineering those analog failure modes into deterministic GPU code. The comments land on something worth noting. Multiple people highlight that the polish distinguishes this from AI-generated equivalents. And they're correct, but the reason is specific. An AI image model can produce something that looks glitchy. It cannot produce something that behaves like broken hardware, because behavior requires a model of the underlying system. The difference between a picture of static and actual signal degradation is the difference between a photograph of fire and combustion. Architecture check. This runs client-side. No server dependency. No account. No upload. The processing model is the correct one for a creative tool. Your camera feed stays on your device because there is no technical reason for it to leave. That's not a privacy feature bolted on after the fact. It's the natural consequence of choosing browser APIs over a cloud pipeline. The tool works on phones. Tap to start, take photos. Apply circuit bent aesthetics to reality in real time. Someone put months of hardware research into understanding why bent cameras produce the images they do. Then put that understanding into a URL anyone can open. The entire signal chain, from CCD physics to WebGL shader, is running on your hardware under your control. That is the correct architecture for a creative tool. From creative tools to management philosophy, Story 10 might be the most contrarian take we've saved for last. Poor Deming never stood a chance. In Joppa and Tri-Mind Day, the Union of Japanese Scientists and Engineers invited an American statistician to Tokyo. W. Edward Deming spent the next decade teaching Japanese manufacturers something radical. Stop managing by targets. Start understanding your systems. By the 1980s, Japanese cars were eating Detroit alive, and American executives were flying to Tokyo trying to figure out what happened. What happened was a fork in the road that this article traces beautifully. Two management thinkers, Drucker and Deming, offered two fundamentally different answers to the same problem. How does a bandwidth-limited manager make sense of a complex organization? Drucker said, set objectives, define measurable key results, monitor the numbers. Deming said, understand the system, study the variation, substitute leadership for numerical targets. The first principles question here is genuinely interesting. Why did Drucker win in America? The article nails it. OKR are compression algorithm. They take the blooming, buzzing confusion of a real organization and reduce it to a spreadsheet. That's not a criticism. That's the feature. A manager drowning in meetings gets a dashboard. Signal from noise. The appeal is obvious, and the implementation is straightforward. Deming asks something harder. He draws on Shewhart's statistical process control. The difference between a system that's noisy but stable and one that's fundamentally out of control. A thermostat that fluctuates within normal bounds versus one that's spiking and crashing. You cannot fix the second one by setting a tighter target temperature. You have to open the thermostat and understand why it's failing. The engineering craft here is in Deming's distinction between common cause and special cause variation. Common cause is the system behaving as designed. Special cause is something broken. Treating common cause variation as a problem to manage. Tightening the target, punishing the outlier, actually makes performance worse. Deming called this tampering. The system fights back. The HN comments surface an important tension. Someone argues Deming only applies to manufacturing, but every software team running sprints with velocity targets is living inside the Drucker model right now. The question isn't whether Deming applies to knowledge work. It's whether we have the patience to understand our systems deeply enough to improve them, or whether the quarterly earnings cycle will always compress us back to the dashboard. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 17th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voiced by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that surprises you. We'll see you back here tomorrow.